So there may be some genetic influences in play. And we have a little bit of evidence from a functional imaging, a brain imaging study we performed, that there may be a difference in connections within the brain between people who visualize vividly, which we've called those people hyperphantasic, and people who lack imagery with aphantasia.
And so since you coined this term and started embarking on research into this, what else have you come to understand about it since then?
Quite commonly, people with aphantasia seem to have a rather thin autobiographical memory. The second association that emerged is a more curious one. It's that quite a number of people with aphantasia have difficulty with face recognition. And then a third association is with autistic spectrum disorder. So a minority of people, but a significant minority of people with aphantasia report autistic spectrum disorder. So my hunch is that aphantasia is more than one thing. I think it's a feature of experience which can occur in a number of different contexts. And one question that we need to answer is to what extent it has subtypes, and we need to know how distinct those subtypes are. So that's work in progress. Really, rather intriguingly, I think, the majority of people with aphantasia dream visually.
That's really interesting, because It seems like it should be, you know, the ability is kind of there, because when you're dreaming, you're not seeing anything in real life. And also our listener, Eileen, who got in touch with us, that was something that she flagged. She says, I know I can visualise things because I do it when I dream.
Yeah, exactly. So that seems pretty strange, doesn't it, at first sight? But actually, neurologically, it makes reasonable sense, I think. And I think one way of conceptualising it, which is perhaps an oversimplification, but it would be to say that dreaming is driven bottom-up. It's involuntary, and it's being driven by signals, impulses from very deep within the brain, whereas imagery during the waking day is a relatively deliberate voluntary process. I think one of the things that this research highlights is just how different our inner lives are.
You're listening to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. Today, we're trying to see what lies behind the door of other people's minds. How do we picture things in our heads? And why can't some people create these images? We've heard how our listener Eileen's aphantasia matches up with many other people's, in that she finds it hard to recognise faces, but she can see images in her dreams. Adam Zeman doesn't consider aphantasia to be a condition or an illness. It's just a different way of being, a quirk of the psyche, as he puts it. But it does raise a lot of intriguing questions about how our brains create our perception of the world. Research into aphantasia is still relatively new, but how do you conduct experiments to measure something as subjective as what people see in their mind's eye?
If you imagine, if you have mental imagery, that is, if you imagine a bright thing or a dark thing, your pupil will constrict when you imagine the bright thing.
No way, really?
Yeah.
This is Joel Pearson. He's a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of New South Wales in Australia, where he runs experiments on visual imagery.
Just like when you look at a light or the sun or something and you get that constriction, it happens with mental imagery as well.
That's incredible. So I guess firstly, that means you've then got something that you can measure, a physiological response. But also, I suppose it tells us something really interesting about what's happening in our brain when we imagine seeing something. It's activating potentially the same parts of the brain, even down to our, you know, the things that control our pupil dilation, that are activated when we do really see something.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like it's tricking your brain into thinking, hey, there's actually a bright thing out in front of me and I'm seeing it. I better close my, you know, my eyes so my retinas don't get damaged by this bright light, even though it's all happening internally, privately, in my visual cortex. So as you probably guessed, if you have aphantasia, you don't get that effect. Your pupils pretty much stay the same, whether you're trying to imagine a bright or a dark thing.
So that's how you kind of go about measuring these things. I'm wondering, what have you found in your research in terms of how people who have aphantasia, so this lack of being able to imagine things visually, how does that affect their responses to the world around them?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the main things we're looking into now. Sort of there's two directions. What happens in the brain? How does the brain create mental imagery? And then how does thinking in pictures or not thinking in pictures change your everyday life, change your cognition, your emotions, your mental health, all these kinds of things? Something else we've been looking at more recently is cravings. So we know that there's been other suggestions that visual mental imagery has been linked to cravings and addiction, but we've started testing that in people with aphantasia and people with imagery, and we see clear differences there. And some of those look like they might also map on to addiction.
So that's the idea that if somebody who's perhaps an alcoholic or is addicted to cigarettes imagines a pint or a cigarette, that if they can do that, then that there's maybe a link there with that driving addictive or compulsive behaviour. Whereas if you are aphantasic, then maybe you can't picture that thing and there's maybe less, it's less strong.
Yeah, exactly.
And is there a link between visual imagery and emotion?
Yeah, there's links between anxiety and particularly post-traumatic stress disorders, or PTSD. So one really interesting study was we got people into a lab, sat them down in a dark, in a little booth. We put a little thing on their finger, which measures the conductivity of the sweat. So it runs a little electric current through the sweat on the skin. So they sit down and they're just reading these words, these scary stories on the computer monitor. If you have mental imagery, we see the skin conductance response measure go up and up and up. If you have aphantasia, it pretty much flatlines. We don't see the same emotional response. So it really suggests that imagery plugs in as this sort of this simulation engine between a story or between thoughts and the emotions. We've published that study. Another study we haven't published yet, we get people into the lab and they watch a pretty nasty video. This is like a car crash video, real footage. And then we send them home and they have a digital diary on their phone and they have to report at random time throughout the day if they've thought about that nasty video. Sort of like this is trying to tap into the kind of visual flashbacks that people have with PTSD. And if you have aphantasia, the number of flashbacks per day you have is way, way lower than if you have visual imagery. So this is really, you know, it's not actual PTSD, but it's getting as close as we can to it in the lab. So I suggest again that if you have aphantasia, you should be at least somewhat immune to parts of PTSD.
Our listener Eileen said that she's a bit jealous of people who can experience visual images, but there may be some advantages to aphantasia if you've been through a traumatic event. Emily Holmes, who we heard from earlier, has been researching treatments to reduce the vivid and upsetting flashbacks that people can have with PTSD, that force them to relive what they've already been through. But the intervention Emily is exploring is rather unexpected. It's based on using the classic computer game, Tetris.
First of all, it would be very gently bring the image to mind, a bit like bringing an image onto your computer screen briefly. The next step is teaching someone how to mentally rotate. And you take a block, for example, you see it, maybe see an L shape, but in your mind's eye, you can flip it 180 degrees, so it goes upside down. And the reason that's important is it really uses sort of visual spatial part of your brain. So we teach people how to mentally rotate and then use the computer gameplay as a way of practicing doing that in a sustained way for about 15 minutes or so. So that they're really concentrating on shape and colour and motion and rotating blocks. So that by the end of this sort of three-step procedure, the hypothesis is, as it were, is the brain is restoring that original difficult image, but in a weaker way. It's not deleting it, it's just putting it, making it less intense so that it's less likely to pop back to mind, less likely to flash back when you don't want to have it.
Emily and her colleagues have recently run clinical trials of the Tetris treatment with frontline healthcare staff working in the COVID-19 pandemic. And the results so far seem promising. On average, people using the intervention reported that the number of flashbacks they experienced went down from 14 a week to just 1 a week. This is still at a research stage, but it shows that a better understanding of how the brain generates visual images could help to treat conditions like PTSD. So, if you can reduce the occurrence of mental images with treatments like this, is it possible to increase them too? Or, as listener Eileen wanted to know, might it even be possible for her to picture images in her head even though she's aphantasic?
We've done one big study where we use a type of brain stimulation where we run a very low electrical current through the brain and actually stimulate the areas right underneath the electrode there to try and see if by stimulating that part of the brain, we could increase, upregulate or downregulate visual mental imagery.
That's Joel Pearson again, Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience.
And we found that for those that did have some mental imagery, we could do that, right? So by stimulating the visual cortex, we could increase the strength of people's imagery or decrease it.
Wow.
Now, these effects weren't massive. We only tested people that had some mental imagery to start off with. So it's a different question whether that technique would apply to someone with aphantasia. I don't think it would by itself. I think you'd have to combine a sort of training regime along with it. So we want to do that experiment, but I'm also a little bit wary, I guess I'd say. Imagery is associated with these sort of PTSD and hallucinations. And if you could give someone imagery in a relatively, you know, short period of time, say a week or two, and they'd never experienced it before, they haven't learned to control it, I would worry that it would become quite difficult to control and they may not enjoy it.
This is something that I had never even considered, that there might be an ethical dimension to giving someone with aphantasia the ability to suddenly visualise things in their heads, especially if they couldn't turn those images off again. For the next stage in his research, Joel wants to find people with aphantasia who previously had the ability to see images, but then lost it, as they may have more control over them and be less likely to suffer potential negative effects.
I'm Marika, I'm one of the Crowd Science producers. When I was preparing to give birth to my daughter, I did a hypnobirthing course where they suggested finding a calm place in your mind where you can go at the point that you have a contraction. So what I did was visualise diving into a swimming pool. It wasn't a particular pool, I just imagined myself jumping off the side and gliding into cool water, and I could really see this in my mind, the sort of blue of the water, the sun shining on it and making a rippling effect, and my own body going in smoothly and then my head breaking the surface. And I found it really helpful to focus on that.
But there's another group of people who may see the world differently in their heads, even though they aren't aphantasic, and that is blind people.
There are different kinds of images.
That's Paul Gabias, a psychologist who researches perception and is also blind. He lost his vision very shortly after birth, and even though he can't produce visual images, he can produce images from his other senses.
There are visual images, auditory images, tactile images, images involving taste and smell. So it would be interesting to know whether she can have any of those images. I think of an image as second order perception. So it would be interesting to see if she can have these second order perceptions in her mind from other senses. I have images, but they're not visual, so they come from all the other senses, so touch and hearing and taste and smell.
So we can think of our senses extract information from the world, and we use that to build up a kind of a mental image of things around us. Maybe it's a table, maybe it's an apple. And for people who are sighted, that information will partly be visual, but for people who aren't sighted, then you would use other senses. But there is still some kind of internal mental representation, an image of that thing that you have.
Yes, it would just follow from the perception, but it's harder to image something, to imagine something that you've never perceived. I mean, our senses are designed so that we perceive the aspects of the world that are important for survival. And so there is often equivalent information available to the different senses. So shape is important. Shape can be perceived visually, it can be perceived tactually. Even though the mechanisms are different between vision and touch, there's a similar process that has to happen inside the brain, and as long as that process happens, then the perception and therefore the image occurs.
So, Paul, if I asked you to imagine an apple, do you have a kind of theatre of the mind in which you can conjure up this mental image of an apple, which will obviously be different from my mental image of an apple, which might be red or something, but can you do that?
Yes, I can, and it won't be that different, except I don't have to put in the colour of the apple, but if I were to put it in, it would be a name.
We wanted to find out what Eileen thinks about all this, along with all the other things we've discovered. We don't yet know why Eileen can't see images in her head, but we do know more about the different physiological responses of people who can and can't see mental images, what we use them for, and how not seeing images can sometimes protect you from reliving traumatic experiences. I suppose the flip side of all of this really is that some people actually, if they have very vivid mental imagery or they do have mental imagery, it seems that because images are kind of very evocative and they create emotions, that there can be a bit of a dark side to it as well. So there's evidence that you're maybe more likely to suffer from cravings and an addiction if you kind of have strong mental images. So it's not always that it's a good thing. There can be disadvantages too.
Yeah, I can see that. And in fact, in my life, I've studied hypnotherapy and neuro-linguistic programming in my time. And a lot of what they talk about is about imagery and switching images in your head. And I always found that a frustrating thing because I couldn't do that when I was trying to do some NLP on myself. And the fact that I can't do it, it's maybe not such a bad thing because it means I don't have such a strong attachment to it in the first place. So yeah, I can see that.
We spoke to one researcher who is blind. When we told him about your story, he was very intrigued and said, well, I'm blind, so I don't have visual mental images, but I still have mental images from my other senses. So I was just wondering, do you have the ability to conjure up images from your other senses?
I would say not. It sounds fabulous, though. So you can tell I'm quite jealous of that, too.
And then one final point to ask you is, you said that you get along perfectly fine. It's not something that's held you back, but it's kind of a curiosity. And, you know, maybe there's a slight bit of, you know, slight bit of frustration that you don't have this thing that other people have. One of the researchers we spoke to said that he has done some work to see whether it's possible to give mental imagery to people that don't have it. And where they're at so far is they've realised that if you sort of stimulate certain parts of the brain, you can increase the strength or decrease the strength of visual imagery in people that already have it. They haven't done it in people that don't have any visual imagery at all, so they haven't made that leap yet.
I think I would like it if I was given the choice. I would like to have mental images. But if someone said, look, we can switch this on, but we can't switch it back off again, I think I'd say yes, please. But that's just me. Everyone has a different way of seeing it. That's maybe why I thought to ask you the question in the first place, because I wondered if it was possible. So, yeah, for me, yeah, I'd like the mental images, but I'm not going to get upset about it. That's it for this episode of Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. The question was from me, Eileen, in Scotland. The show was presented by Anand Jagatia and produced by Joe Glanville. If you have a question on any science subject and you want the team to investigate, why not email crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Goodbye.
Licht fällt auf die Seite. Der Herbstwind fegt die Straße leer. Jetzt stehst du da an der Laterne mit Tränen im Gesicht.
Lucifer, son of the morning, I'm gonna chase you out of earth. Shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Satan is an evil host man, but him can't choke sit on I man. So when I check him, my lass in hand, and if him slip a gun with him hand, I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space. Shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Satan is an evil host man, but him can't choke sit on I man. So when I check him, my lass in hand, and if him slip a gun with him hand, I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space.
We'll be right back. Shape Plus platform, co-funded by the European Union and Pro Helvetia.
Hello, I am Marie Delprat, a musician, composer and performer based in Switzerland and currently part of the Shape Plus platform. I have been playing the recorder for many years and studied early music. That's where actually my path started. Later, I felt the need to move toward electronics, to explore a different kind of sound world where textures, rhythms, and noise could mix with the same depth and precision as classical music. My work moves somewhere between acoustic and electronic sound, between bodies, machines, and spaces. Collaborations are very important and a central element in my work. For me, they open always new perceptions, new imaginations, and they allow me to meet others through sound. What you're listening right now is the ouverture from my solo performance, Ethereal Realms, All Fiction is Metaphor. It's a work that unfolds like a live experience where I'm very close to the audience. It reflects on transformation, on what it means to have a human body in a world of machines, and how fragility can become a quiet form of resistance. After this introduction, we will move on with Trance, a track that we made together with David Gore and Masha Ten last summer. Then you will hear two tracks from Maritronics, my duo with Masha Ten, Agitated Hurt Part 2 and MDMT, both from our first album, Doll Star Doll. After that comes Happily Destroyed, a 20-minute improvisation track made in collaboration with David Koch. At this time, we didn't know each other, and we met at a local radio station in Bern named Life at Zoo. That happened during the second lockdown in 2021, where the only way to share live music was through radio. At the end, we will be back to the soundtrack of my solo performance, Act 3, the final track of it. I wanted to create 1 hour music that could move between distortion and tenderness, emotion and resistance, desire and what remains after it. I really hope you will enjoy the journey. Take care, and maybe see you soon.